Wildfires rage in California, leaving only a trail of ashes in their wake. Coastal cities are battered by hurricanes with little time to recover before the next big storm hits. And devastating 500-year floods now strike every year. The United Nations' recent Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report confirms that these catastrophes are no coincidence. We are living in a world different from the generations before us. This is no new normal. It is more like the end of normal. And these devastating changes are already happening fast. David Wallace Wells wrote a New York Magazine article on the effects of climate change that went viral in 2017. He has now broadened that into the new book, The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming, where he lays out a new roadmap for navigating this transformed world. David Wallace Wells is a journalist. He is also the National Fellow at the New America Foundation and a columnist and deputy editor at New York Magazine. And it's a pleasure to welcome David Wallace Wells to the roundtable this morning. David, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
What brought you to this subject?
Well, I'm a journalist who's always been interested in the near future, particularly the near future of science and technology. And a couple of years ago, I was seeing many really alarming reports coming out from climate science and academic journals. And as a magazine editor, I was also looking around at the places I think of as my competitors and not seeing those stories told adequately in those places, in those newspapers, in those magazines, in the, on television. And I felt that there was a sort of enormous storytelling opportunity there, that climate change was starting to look a lot bleaker and scarier than most people understood. And yet, that set of facts was not really being shared with the public. In fact, it was sort of being shielded from the public. And I felt that there was an opportunity there, just a journalistic opportunity there. The deeper that I got into the research, the bigger the story seemed, the scarier it seemed. Things were getting worse much faster than I think most people understood. But it also, all of the impacts sort of came together to seem something like a all-encompassing latticework that surrounds our entire lives. So, you might have thought that if you lived off the coast, you'd be safe in the time of climate change because sea levels were about the worst that was going to happen. But when you start to realize that, well, climate change impacts economic growth, and the researchers who study that believe that by the end of the century, if we don't change course, global GDP could be between 20% and 30% lower than it would be without climate change, or conflict, so that by the end of the century, again, if we don't change course, we could see as much as twice as much war as we do today. There are impacts on agricultural yields, which could fall by half. There are impacts on public health, in addition to the sort of more familiar ones of extreme weather and heat wave and drought. And when you start to see all of those different impacts projected simultaneously, you realize that this is not something that is compartmentalizable socially, and it's not even really compartmentalizable mentally. It is a total system. It's a global system. It sounds naive to say it, but every time any one of us walk down the street, we're walking through nature, through climate, and when that climate is disturbed, is perturbed, is changed, it is likely going to change a lot about the way that we live together on this planet, which is really the sort of big subject of my book, not just what climate change is and promises, but what it will mean for our politics and our geopolitics, what it will mean for our culture and pop culture and storytelling, how it'll change our relationship to technology and to economics. And I do think this is a whole sort of category of inquiry that even those people who are very serious and very concerned about climate change haven't yet begun to think all that deeply about, not just what's going to happen, but what it will mean to the way that we organize our lives and our societies on an Earth that is, say, 2 or 3 or 4 degrees warmer, which will be quite scary and terrifying, but will still be, a climate that will allow for human life and flourishing. And so exactly how we navigate that warmed future is really the subject of the book.
So journalistically, scientifically, how do you extrapolate the data that we have now to determine what that future looks like, what life will be like or could be like after warming?
It's a very complicated set of questions, and many of the answers to that are, on, for instance, how you could project the future of wildfires are beyond my technical expertise. So personally, my work is really drawing on collating the research of other scientists. I mean, I was careful to be drawing almost entirely from papers that were published in the best journals and had been references in other people's papers and, you know, were sort of credentialed and pedigreed in that way. But I'm not doing that research myself. And in fact, I think that some of those projections are likely to prove false. That's how science proceeds, that, you know, some predictions and projections are revised and undone over time. And I don't think that every single point in the book is likely to come to pass exactly as it's projected to. But on the big picture science, our understanding of the effect of carbon in the atmosphere is quite solid and quite simple. The more carbon there is, the more heat is trapped in the planet's atmosphere. And that was understood as long ago as the 19th century. And basically all of the temperature changes that we've seen on the planet over the last 50 years or so track exactly with that very basic rudimentary understanding that was developed way back then. So the science of warming is, as a sort of big picture story, is very simple. What it means, again, in terms of exactly how many acres are going to burn from California wildfires in the year 2070, or exactly how much sea level rise there will be, those are more complicated questions. And most scientists would say that any prediction should come expressed as a range and with some uncertainty attached. And I tried to express some of that uncertainty in the book, although I also feel that the major driver of uncertainty about climate change is really what we do going forward, because if the main input in the climate system that will change it further is how much carbon we put into the atmosphere, then ultimately what the atmosphere looks like 30, 50, 80 years from now is a matter of what we do going forward. And I think that's a really important thing for everyone to understand, that however harrowing and horrifying the climate future looks like when you consider everything the science tells us about where we'll be a few decades from now, all of those projections are ultimately a reflection of our power over the climate system. So if we get to 4 degrees by the end of the century, as the UN, IPCC, and most scientists would say we're on track to, we'll get there because of what we do from here on out. It's not something that's set in stone. It's not something that's inevitable. And while there are a lot of reasons to think we won't be able to take action on carbon emissions as quickly as we might like, you know, given our politics, given the inertia of our culture and our economy, et cetera, nevertheless, all of the inputs are ours to control. And therefore, we can write our own climate story here. But the story that we are writing right now is quite terrifying. We're at 1.1 degrees Celsius of warming already. And that means we're already outside of the entire window of temperature that encloses all of human history. So the planet is now warmer than it has ever been before when humans were around to walk it. That means, to me, it's an open question whether humans would have ever evolved in the first place if the planet was always this warm. It's certainly an open question. I think we would have, but it's certainly an open question whether we would have developed agriculture and through agriculture civilization if the planet had always been this warm, because in the parts of the planet where we did develop agriculture, the Middle East, it's already a lot harder to grow crops, and the idea of starting that whole system from scratch seems really difficult to imagine. But we're headed for more warming. I think it's quite unlikely that we stay below 2 degrees of warming with anything like conventional decarbonization, that is just retiring dirty energy and replacing it with clean energy sources. And at 2 degrees, the UN thinks we will have 200 million climate refugees. Several of the major ice sheets in the Antarctic will begin an irreversible and permanent melt, which, while that melt will take centuries, will ultimately mean as much as 200 feet of sea level rise or more. And we're on track for 4 degrees of warming, which would mean, I mentioned that, you know, 20 to 30% smaller GDP. There are estimates that climate impacts could total, in terms of dollars, $600 trillion, which is double all the wealth that exists in the world today. We would have more than twice as much war than we see today. And the impacts are truly terrifying. We could have as many as 64 times as much acreage burned by California wildfires as we see now. And considering that more than 1 million acres were burned this past year, that's quite terrifying. So the story that we're writing now is horrible, but it's entirely within our power to change that story. We just need to take action quick, which, unfortunately, I don't think there's much hope of our doing in time to avert, say, 2 degrees or 2.5 degrees when the beginning of what most scientists call catastrophic warming will really set in.
David Wallace Wells is our guest. The name of the new book is The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming. The point that you make, as you mentioned, one of the main things here is that this warming, the world that is remade by this warming, is all-encompassing. And every aspect of our life, you point out, is going to be impacted, shaped, distorted by this. And I think that's what makes your book so interesting, because you look at it how it changed our politics and our culture and our relationship to technology. And give us a sense of those areas, what it is about the science and our climate that can control us in such significant ways not too far in the future.
Well, it gets back to what I said earlier, which is that as much as we think otherwise, we all live within climate. And so everything about what we do every day is conducted in this climate theater. And when that climate changes, it has impacts down to the way that we live. So, for instance, people do worse on tests. Cognitive performance is lower when it's warmer out. They also do worse on tests when there's air pollution in the air, which is a side effect of climate change. The same is true of babies in development. So you can see the effect on a baby's lifelong earnings by the number of days above 90 degrees it spent in its mother's womb. So temperature impacts the development of children even while they're still in utero. And air pollution is the same way. You can see those impacts so dramatically that, for instance, when they instituted Easy Pass in the U.S., and that meant that cars were not slowing down around tolls and not producing extra exhaust, you could see the impacts on premature birth and low birth weight immediately. These are just some of the impacts, but I mentioned the economic impacts. As anyone who has tried to work on a hot summer day knows, heat can be stultifying and can decrease productivity. And it sounds a little weird to say it, but you actually see those impacts at the national level. So there, scientists who study this have identified a kind of ideal temperature for economic productivity. It's about 13 degrees Celsius, which is the historical median average of the United States and a few of the world's other most productive economies. But we're now warmed past that. So the U.S. is now at about 13.5 degrees Celsius, I think. And the economists who study this material say that it could be costing us as much as a half percentage point of GDP every year. But there are parts of the country that have, because of warming, grown more hot. So at the moment, Silicon Valley is right at that ideal temperature for economic productivity, which is obviously interesting given that they're the part of the country that most of us think of as the most productive. And the impacts on public health and agriculture is really dramatic. So if we end up at 4 degrees by the end of the century, we could have grain yields that are only half as bountiful as they are today. And the impact on our social lives and our political lives, I think, is less about each of these individual discrete scientific inquiries than it is and impacts than it is the sum total of all of them. I think it's easy to think that, say, if we only had to deal with sea level rise, well, we could probably figure out a way to do that. Maybe we'd engineer some technological solution to keep the ice sheets stable, or we'd build sea walls where we needed to, and we'd evacuate those areas where we decided were going to be not worth the trouble. Those would be enormous engineering feats, but they're sort of theoretically possible. You can imagine them. The problem with climate change is that its impacts are everywhere, and they build on each other and make the impacts worse, so that if a country is dealing with, for instance, drought and famine, but also reduced economic productivity and also increased propensity to violence because of temperature, that's a really bad mix. And that is in fact already happening in much of the world. The people who study this say that, you can't say that the Syrian civil war was directly and solely caused by climate change, but it's certainly the case that the drought that was climate related was a factor. And we are now almost 10 years deep in the complete social disarray that unleashed. And then that has cascading effects elsewhere in the world. So the Syrian refugee crisis, that was only about 1 million Syrian refugees who made their way to Europe. The civil war produced more than that, but only about 1 million made their way to the continent. And that has completely destabilized European politics, and through Europe, global geopolitics. the entire populist moment that we're passing through in the West right now is tied up in the fate of those Syrian refugees. And the UN thinks that we're going to have a global climate refugee crisis that's possibly 200 times bigger and possibly more than that. I think some of those numbers are a little bit inflated. But nevertheless, you see, we're entering into a world that will be destabilized in almost every way by these forces. I think we are resilient and adaptive, and we'll find ways to endure and reinvent new forms of security and prosperity. But it will be a very different world from the one we live in now. And so I think if a person born in 2000 is considering the end of their life at the end of the 21st century, it'll be like someone who was born in the year 1780 in England and looking back at the end of their life in 1880. Those are the scale of transformations that we're living through. This will be an era that is defined by climate change in the same way that earlier ones were defined by, say, modernity or financial capitalism. And we don't yet know all of those impacts, but I think they will be quite profound and really destabilizing to everything that we've taken for granted as the kind of eternal features of modern life.
In the final chapter of your book, you write, "What if we're wrong? Perversely, decades of climate denial and disinformation have made global warming not merely an ecological crisis, but an incredibly high-stakes wager on the legitimacy and validity of science and the scientific method itself. It is a bet that science can win only by losing, and in this test of the climate, we have a simple sample size of just one." What do you make of where we are now, that when much of the scientific world is saying we have to go, we have to move, we have to do something, we have to do something, we have to do something, and there is a large part of the political world that is saying, eh, we're okay?
Yeah, it's a big problem. I think that we're beginning to see our politics change. I think that, you know, at the grassroots level, the climate strike in Europe, Extinction Rebellion in the U.S., there's been Sunrise, and the impact that's had on Democratic politics through the Green New Deal proposal. Those are all really encouraging signs, and the Green New Deal proposal in particular, while it's quite vague and there are a lot of things to be hammered out, I think is laudable in the sense that it puts the science front and center. The resolution opens with a lot of quoted language from the UN's IPCC report saying what needs to be done. And I think this is a real sea change to be building our political goals off of scientific consensus rather than defining what is possible through the prism of partisan politics, which is we'll define very little as quite possible. But I think at the higher levels of policymaking, I think there's likely to be change too. And I say that because I think for a long time, there was a kind of economic conventional wisdom that held that action on climate would be very expensive, not just in the sense of requiring massive investment, but also in the sense of foregoing some kind of economic growth, some amount of economic growth. And that conventional wisdom really restrained policymakers who were quite concerned with economic productivity in the ways that they were running their countries. The new economic research from the last few years actually really reverses that logic entirely. It's quite exciting in that respect, even though it reverses that logic in part by saying that the costs of climate change are going to be much, much bigger than we anticipated. But the new economic conventional wisdom is really that fast action on climate change, on decarbonization, is going to be hugely beneficial economically and in relatively short order. There was a major study last year that suggested the global economy could add $26 trillion by 2030 by rapid decarbonization. That's a very fast payoff. That new conventional wisdom, I think, hasn't yet gotten to our policymakers. They haven't yet grokked it. But once they do, I do think that they will have a basically different perspective and position than policymakers, say, 10 years ago did. The question then becomes, you know, we have this huge international collective action problem. Every nation is sort of incentivized to move more slowly and let other countries do more aggressive work. How do we solve that problem? And that'll be the case even if every leader in the world is really mobilized to take action on climate. There will still be this kind of collective action dilemma. And that's one reason why I think that we're likely to see over the next couple of decades a really rebuilt global politics. And I don't mean to say in that sense that, like, we're about to usher in an era of total anarchy or anything like that, although I think that's conceivable. I don't think it's likely. Much more likely to me is that we have something like, you know, the model that we developed right after World War II, which was a liberal international order built on the principles of human rights and peace and prosperity. And while those weren't principles that were honored in every respect around the world, they were the sort of guiding principles of most interaction between nations. I think it's quite likely that we see, in relatively short order, climate and carbon becoming one of those principles, one of those core principles, and maybe even supplanting the others as the prime principle. And I think that's why you see things like MBS, the sort of problematic leader of Saudi Arabia, saying that his country needs to be, their economy needs to be entirely off oil by 2050. Because he understands, as grotesque as his political logic is in other ways, he understands that a country can't produce and burn oil like Saudi Arabia has and still expect a place at the table of nations going forward. The geopolitics will just be very, very different very soon and won't allow that to happen. I think those kinds of changes are going to happen at every level, at our community level of community politics, national politics, but also in other spheres, so that we're walking down our supermarket aisle. You know, we're already familiar with organic labels. We're likely to see carbon-free labels. There's likely to be a kind of competition about who is going to live within the smallest carbon footprint. It's going to affect our storytelling and our pop culture such that, you know, science fiction, which has depicted environmental apocalypse, will need to adapt when the real world is offering similar images and similar stories. Those impacts are going to be felt at the level of child rearing, when people decide to have children and in what form. And, you know, those impacts are sort of all-encompassing, as I say. I think they'll be everywhere we look. And we can't yet quite see what form they will take, but my book is a kind of initial attempt to sketch out the landscape.
The name of the new book is The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming. It is published by Tim Duggan Books. David Wallace Wells, thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.